Your Partner in Success Radio is a free business podcast with host Denise Griffiths. It's all about great stories, conversation, and context to help you move your business and life forward with actionable tips and advice from her guest experts. To listen and subscribe, just find us on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you consume your podcasts.
Good morning and welcome to Your Partner in Success Radio. This is where top performers share their secrets to help you achieve your personal and your professional goals. I am your host, Denise Griffiths, and together with my amazing guests, we bring you inspiring and actionable insights that are aimed to take your life and your business to the next level. Ranked in the top 2% globally, this podcast really is a must-listen. And again, it's because of my guests. So whether you are tuning in for entrepreneurial tips, career advice, or personal development strategies, get ready to turn inspiration into action, challenges into triumphs, and dreams into reality. And our topic today with my returning guest, Daryl Lyons, is navigating the complexity of ethical investing and aligning your financial goals with your personal values. Now, Daryl has been here before, as I mentioned. He is the driving force behind PAX, P-A-X Financial Group, and he is not your typical CEO. He traded Wall Street Dreams for a He traded Wall Street Dreams for a Texan adventure, founding PAX to redefine wealth alignment. And raised without privilege, he knows the value of genuine happiness over wealth. And he's not just about business. He's a reformer, leading projects, publishing, and co-founding a nonprofit in Moldova. His faith is his compass, guiding him through church committees and mentoring sessions. And with Daryl, it's not just about money. It's about purpose. Daryl, good morning. Welcome back to Your Partner in Success Radio.
It's good to be back. Thank you for having me again.
Oh, I wouldn't have missed this for the world. We had such a terrific time the last time you were here, and you have a fascinating story. And I will, you know, get you to, you know, maybe reiterate. I've been drinking a lot of tea this morning, and it's making me jittery.
Not coffee.
I don't drink coffee.
Not sweet tea.
No. Oh, God. No. That stuff is nasty. You live in the South. I live in the South. It's ubiquitous. It's everywhere, but don't touch it. It's awful.
It is sugar.
Oh, it is. It's just a giant sugar cube with a little bit of brown water poured over it.
Right.
Not good for you. So tell people a bit about you, and then I really want to get into your book, Biblical Responsible Investing. So just kind of reiterate what you told our audience about you the last time you were here.
Yeah. So, you know, I moved around a little bit, but basically lived in South Texas. And it was a challenge because my mom had me when she was 16 and my dad was 20. So they, you know, they worked hard, but they did struggle when the economy struggled in the 80s. There was the savings and loans crisis, and that kind of moved my parents into a financial status that was very difficult to get out of. So my dad lost his job and we moved around a bit and he was trying to find his footing. And so growing up with financial struggles, we ended up moving to Castroville, Texas, a small town right outside of San Antonio. And we lived in a little trailer there on the side of the highway. And it just began to really define me because I just saw a lot of the challenges, not only just like not having stuff, but also how, you know, lack of money can, and your response to lack of money can really be, you know, create a lot of tension for a family. And so for me growing up, I just wanted to figure out how people had had money. I remember like edging the skirting of our trailer. And I was thinking, because you got to be careful with the weed eater that you don't crack the white skirting. And I just remember thinking, how in the world do people have houses with foundations? Like that would be cool to have a house with a foundation one day. And so I was inspired by the local banker whose daughter was a friend of mine. And I thought, well, okay, banking is a ticket to have a house with a foundation. And I became, that's how I paid my way through college, was working at a bank. But I became really infatuated with money and just curious about money. And so I got a degree in accounting, another one finance, went on, got graduate work done, and been studying this space of money for a very long time. And the revelation over the years, it just never ceases to amaze me how I continue to have revelation. God gives me like just peculiar aha moments about money. And specifically, one of the things that's been interesting is just seeing how, you know, I was trained very much in the math and the academic sense of corporate finance. But the reality is that it's really about human behavior. And just then it's transitioned the way I think about money into this area of study called behavioral finance, which is a collision of psychology, traditional finance, and even a little bit of a therapy in there to a certain degree. So, but just realizing that this idea of money and math is an element of commerce, but only an element. Much of it has to do with our behavior. And so I'm convinced of that. And that just brings a new level of interest that I have about it. And then of course, then the next level is how does that align with faith? And so it's just a fascinating area of study for me, and it continues to amaze me. That's a long answer to a short question. Sorry.
It's okay, because I was going to ask you, why did you write this book? And I think you got to me before I could ask you.
Well, it's a good question, but that to unpack that a little bit more, I did this video and we pushed it on YouTube, and it was, what we did is as a company is we gave our employees some money for them to turn around and give it to a nonprofit, which was an exciting experience for all of us. So we filmed this experience so the employees could enjoy giving, and we filmed it. We actually, you know, took a studio or took cameras to the nonprofits and delivered a check for whatever, how much money. And it was, I mean, collectively it was a substantial amount of money. So I recorded that. And in the facilitation of this documentary, for lack of a better word, I was like praising God. I was like, man, God has given us the ability to do this. So then after that, one of my top clients came to me and says, you know, I love what you did. Your heart was in the right place, giving to the community. But that idea of adding God into there, that's a little too religious for me. And so I thought, okay, well, I don't want to offend her. So, and offend anybody else. So the next production that we did, same thing, I actually removed God. And then it dawned on me, I was watching and it dawned on me, I go, that's really hypocritical of you, because that's not who you are. And then I really spent a lot of time camping on my hypocrisy. And because the idea is that I want to be the same person at home and at work. And so that was like, that was a really important point in my life, because that was when I said, okay, I think it's probably time for me just to just kind of live out my faith and just express it on, you know, it is what it is. And so then I started to write about it, and I started to become more, not vocal about it, but more authentic and genuine. And it became less about hiding it or, you know, being embarrassed about it. There's some scriptures about being lukewarm that ping me. But then again, being long-winded, sorry. I during COVID, I you know, I was bored. So Texas A&M Law School has this master's program that I took, and it was great. It was Masters of Jurisprudence. It was very in-depth wealth management curriculum. And so I did that, and I had to write a paper, and the paper that I wrote was designed to encourage executives who I had some great relationships with, BlackRock and Goldman Sachs. I was on their advisory council, and the paper that I was writing was to encourage these executives to consider the economic influence of the Christian community, because Christians hold 55% of the world's wealth. And it didn't seem like at that time they were really being accommodative to the unique characteristics and motivations of this Christian community, and they were discounting them. So I wrote a paper to compel them to reconsider how they think about money to really accommodate these unique needs. And that paper fell on that document fell on deaf ears. But I looked at the manuscript and I go, you know, this would also be helpful for the consumer, because I'm not sure the consumer understands that there's these unique financial solutions in the marketplace that can serve the Christian community that has unique desires and motivations. And so I reconstructed the paper to make it friendly for the consumer, the everyday person, to read. And that's what ultimately became the book, Biblical Responsible Investing. And so that's my journey. It's of just kind of leaning into my faith and where I'm at today.
And I'm glad you did. And I have this book in front of me. And thank you for sending it to me. It's an easy to read book. And I think I mentioned this in a book review that I just did for, Biblical Responsible Investing not too long ago. But it's a pocket-sized book. You can, if you need to have something in your purse, I don't know about you, I don't travel without some kind of book. It's either on my Kindle or I've got it in my bag. If I'm on an airplane, which I don't do that much anymore.
Yeah.
I've got to have a book. I read. I'm a voracious, voracious reader. But the beauty about this book is it's fairly small. It's slim. You can put it in, take it on the plane with you. You can take it to the gym with you if you're, on a treadmill and you want something to look at. You can take it to the doctor's office with you. It fits perfectly in your bag because it's got no weight to it at all. It's a nice book, but I
Thank you.
Really, my pleasure. But what I like about this book, and listen, I am not religious. I never have been, but I have deep Christian values. Mm-hmm. A lot of us do. We're not going to belong to organized religion, but that doesn't mean we don't have deep beliefs.
Yeah.
And I think we're kind of being, although I started, let me finish my sentence. I think we're largely being kind of slammed around on social media, and particularly in the media, the legacy media. But people are fighting back, I've noticed.
Yeah, it's been very interesting. One of the things that I mentioned in my book is that there's been, there was this massive movement to really not consider diversity of opinion that was really lost on a lot of corporate America. And what Christians did, or those who hold deeply that have deeply held convictions that are aligned with the Christian community, as you mentioned, what they did is, and I'm part of that group, got complacent. And so we didn't really communicate or engage with corporate America, because we just felt like we just kind of were running the show and it wasn't a big deal. Well, a lot of activists engaged with corporate America, and this was expressed. You saw some of the overflow of that with Target and Bud Light and many other companies. And they didn't consider the diversity of opinion, that people have deeply held convictions here. They just didn't consider it, but they didn't consider it because Christians got complacent. So when it came around and it started to really impact people's lives, as an example, if you own Target stock and you were a Christian and you saw that the pushback from the direction they had gone had resulted in material losses of your stock, you were very frustrated, because you're like, it's one thing to disagree with kind of the direction they went, but it's another thing to be a shareholder and to lose money because of what they did. Mm-hmm. And so Christians started to say that's no longer acceptable. So what we started to see, and it's very much alive now, is on the advocacy front, that we're using our corporate our shareholder privileges of proxy voting to be able to have a seat at the table and begin to say to corporate America and CEOs in the boardroom, we represent a group with a different opinion, and here's how they feel about the decision and direction you're going. And that's just good for America in general. And so that was not happening for a long time because of complacency, but it is happening today. And I assure you, because I've actually had a lot of conversations with these advocates, and they're making a ton of progress. It's unbelievable. And so now corporations, and you've seen it, they're going back to just being businesses. And we're not, as Christians, it's collectively not asking them to be advocates for something that's deeply held convictions of Christianity. We're asking, and I can't speak for everyone necessarily, but most of them who are in this proxy engagement conversation with CEOs and executives, most of them are just simply saying, just get back to business. Don't get involved with nonsense or peripheral groups. You have to cater, you have to be able to serve shareholders, you have to be able to serve employees, you have to be able to serve customers. And we are convinced that if you add a fourth group to that, which would be these, you know, advocacy, these groups that have special interests, if you add that and give undue attention to it, it really, something's going to fail, whether with your employees, your customers, or your shareholders. And so what most of these institutions are doing that represent Christian values are really pushing back, and you're seeing it a lot today. And I think we're getting a better corporate America as a result of it, but it's happening a lot. Yeah,
it is. And, you know, since I left Twitter 3 or 4 years ago, because it was a sewer, it was a cesspit. And then when Elon Musk took it back over, I thought, well, let me go see. And I actually enjoy being on Twitter now. I mean, it still has problems. I mean, you get millions of people on one platform, there are going to be problems. But the word I see the most, or maybe it just pops out in front of me because I'm so aware of what's going on, is boycott. It's a big word on Twitter, and it's becoming almost part of the American experience. If you do something so ugly, and in my opinion, that idiotic move with Bud Light was just beyond bizarre, you deserve to be boycotted.
Yeah, people are voting with their corporate dollars, which
that's
is good.
That's exactly right.
And now they're also voting with their investment dollars. So that's, you know, part of what PAX has done is started to shift assets. And we're not doing it. So we have discretionary authority. So when somebody invests with us, they give us discretionary authority to move money around. That's as long as it's aligned with their risk profile, time horizon, and all those, what their preferences are. So we don't move money around because we have convictions. We actually sit down with the client and say, if you have convictions in this space, do you want us to shift money from, let's say, BlackRock over to some biblical responsible investing? So we're having a lot of clients do that now based on what they want. And so not only are people boycotting with their dollars, their debit cards, they're boycotting with their investments. And so we're seeing that a lot. There's a large shift. It's going to take some time because there's, you know, State Street and Vanguard and BlackRock, they still have the majority of assets in the entire world. But there is a movement of people boycotting with their investment dollars as well.
They are. And there's a lot of quiet boycotting going on. I'm one of those people. I'm not going to jump up and say, I'm never going to support you again. I just never mess with you again. I'm like, I'm out of here.
Yeah, it's just nonsense.
It is. And I love what you say about, you know, corporate didn't, some of these decisions, you have to wonder, there's one or two CEOs, and I won't mention who they are, but I wonder if their mama mashed their soft spots too hard. Yeah. There's something wrong with how these people think. It's like, what happened to you? But it's one thing to be, in my view, moderately to, you know, mildly to moderately insane, to messing with people's livelihoods because of your insanity. So there's that.
Well, you know, it's a really good point. And one of the things that, and I'm with you, I probably maybe different, and we're all kind of different in the way we approach our spiritual walk. But, you know, the idea of organized religion is just frustrating to me in a lot of ways.
Yeah, it will never be for me. I admire people who can go to church and stay in church and believe in church. I'm not one of those people, but I'm an introvert. So that's part of it. I don't want to be around a lot of people all jumping up and down and doing the same thing. I catch my eyebrows hitting my hairline going, what the heck?
Yeah.
So, church is not for me.
That makes sense. You know, I think that's helped a lot of introverts with some of the online churches. Now, you know, one of the things that I enjoy about whenever I read the Bible, I've read it every day for probably 20 years now. And what's really interesting is that none of this is new. Like, so one of these CEOs and their asinine ways of making decisions, and I have no idea, to your point, like, in what way did you develop this decision-making way of life? But I look at, like, even the Old Testament. See, this is what I love about the Bible. When I read it, I see examples of kings who have done this. Like, there's this guy named Uzziah in the Old Testament. He was a king. And he just became full of pride, and he would no longer listen to people around him, and he thought he was God. And so it's not lost on me that when some of these people get too powerful, that how they will behave, there's plenty of examples that I've seen in historical texts that show me that this has gone on for years. And so it's not a surprise to me. It's just how do we navigate this? And then if I'm in a position, because I serve on nonprofit boards, I look for that, you know, some of these conditions that put people in leadership roles that's real problematic. And it really comes down, and most people will say, when you do leadership studies, most people say that even above and beyond intelligence, values and integrity are priorities for having a good leader. And but some of these founders aren't, you know, they aren't in a leadership role because they were chosen. They were in a leadership role because they started the company, and then they end up in a leadership role, and you know, they become, you kind of see that they are wolves in sheep's clothing.
Exactly. And listen, I don't want to talk about politics on the show. I try to avoid it, and I turn people away sometimes because that's their thing, and God bless them, but I'm not the right person for that. But on chapter one, you dive straight into political motivations, and I have to tell you, I will not mark up a book. It's against my religion. I cannot do it. I was taught when I was raised in a library practically that you don't harm books, but I sticky note the heck out of them. And political motivations, and you start out, Christians have decided that the two political parties don't match their values and are turning in their political badges. Been there, done it. I have a family member who has been a staunch lifelong Democrat. She turned in her badge. She said, I can't do this anymore. And I'm not talking just about Democrats or Republicans. I'm talking about all of them.
Well, you're right. I think what we fail to do is really take inventory of our values. And so, and this has gone on forever, is that we tend to vote and vote for the person that we like, or the against the person we don't like. But really, I think what we've done over the last several years, which is healthy in a lot of ways, is finally say, what do I really believe to be important to me? What are my values? And so at that point, when you've fully, in a critical way, thought deeply about your values and what's important to you, at that point, then you're in a better position to vote, because now you're voting for somebody who aligns with your values. And what happens is you wake up and you go, wait, neither of these candidates are aligned with my values, or neither of these parties. Of course, then you settle to a place where you say, okay, I can't get 100% alignment. I have to kind of get mostly aligned. But I think we've gotten to a point where now people are starting to say, okay, this is what I believe to be true, and these are my values. And it's less about politics. It's more about deeply held convictions, which is really a more mature place to be than making election decisions based on feelings and emotions. That's what teenagers do. But mature adults, they take inventory of their values, their convictions, what's really important to them, and then they vote based on that. And that's what we're seeing today.
Right. One of my political conviction is never vote for the incumbents. Just don't. I had, you know, once they've done their time, they need to go home. They've done their time. They've done their damage. Now go home. But I had the silly season. I call it the silly season when, you know, politicians knock on the door and they spam the doorknob with their flyers. It just drives me crazy. And I have a sign on my door that's been here since I bought this house. I typed it up. I stuck it to the door, and it says, in no uncertain terms, if you have not been invited or I'm not expecting you, do not knock or ring the doorbell. That's pretty pithy, isn't it?
Yeah.
But I have a glass, the top of my door is glass, and I'll have the blinds up just so I can, you know, get some sunshine. And politicians, honest to God, they will look me right in the eye as I'm passing through the living room and knock on that door. And I just stand there and look at them. I might wave with a finger.
Yeah.
Depending on how irritated I am. But one time I did answer the door, and it was a politician that I knew well, a local politician. He had done his two terms. Now he was trying to move into another part of the government. A doctor, you know, very well known here in town. And he said, Denise, I would love to have your vote. And I said, I'm sorry. No. And I explained to him why. You've done your time. It's, you know, this is not what the founding fathers wanted. I happen to agree with them. This is not a career. You're a doctor. Go doctor. And he did lose, by the way.
Well, that's powerful, and obviously Congress has a really bad,
Oh,
it
yeah.
really, I mean, this is just horrible
Yeah.
now. That makes zero sense.
Yeah.
So,
Well, it does if you're them,
yeah,
but
it's a
it
great
doesn't for the
business.
rest of
I have no, it
exactly
blows
right.
me away how wealthy they become for being a public servant. It just,
No.
it's mind-blowing.
It's grift. They grift
Yeah.
everything. I have zero faith in politicians. So let's go. I wanted to go where find my sticky note. So checkers versus chess. That's chapter two. Let's dive into that a bit.
Yeah, so really what it comes down to it is Christians when it I use this with air quotes because people describe themselves as Christians who may or may not they may go to church on Easter Sunday and they may read the Bible periodically, and there's just not like they kind of believe in Jesus. But Christians, there's something called practicing Christians where actually studies have gone in. Barna does a good job and says, okay, who, I know people say they're Christians, but who are those that actually really like pray every day or read the Bible every day or do kind of Christian things. And so the practicing Christians is what those groups are called, the ones that do things. And so giving would be an example of that. They give to nonprofits or they serve. So there's a group that you can actually, as a subset of Christians in general, there's a group that actually are followers of Jesus, which would be Christians. Used to be called people of the way. In the ancient texts, they were called people of the way because they did things differently. And they still exist today. And the people of the way are Christians. So what you find is that they have a different motivation for a lot of financial on a lot of financial topics. As an example, they, like I said, they give twice as much as a secularist. It's interesting. And so that's a different motivation of life. And let's, another one would be legacy. They have a very deeply held conviction on what it means to leave a legacy and how you translate those values to the next generation and also giving some money to the next generation. So, they can, continue those values or giving to nonprofits. Certainly there's crossover between secularists and Christians. But the vast, you can see there's completely different motivations when it comes to money. I mean, even retirement, as an example, that's not really a biblical thought. It's expressed once mildly in the Old Testament, but the idea of retirement is not something that's should be embraced by the Christian community as a whole. It should be an idea where you pivot into the next chapter and give wisdom to the next generation. So, if you look at different elements of our financial lives, you can see that there's really a completely different money game between a secular America and a Christian America. And so once you understand kind of there's a different motivation of how to do money, then I think it's incumbent upon the financial systems to be able to accommodate some of those needs. One final example, health insurance, and this is a chapter in the book as well. Christians have developed over 20 years a completely different model for health insurance. Like it's radically different. And it's called Christian Sharing Programs, and it's been working maybe 30 years now.
I belong to one, have done for many, many years.
And it's that's a completely different model. And so everything about the Christian way of, there's 2,000 scriptures about money. That's more than faith and prayer combined. It's just a completely different way of life. And so I've worked with a lot of, like, I don't do financial advisory work, but I've sat down kneecap to kneecap with thousands of people about money. And it's just different. A lot of people in the secular community, their goal is to build up a lot of wealth for, it's a scorecard, and that's just not the game for Christians.
Well, and one thing, and I wrote this down while you were talking, when you're giving, when you're donating, when you're sharing, it really isn't about the tax write-offs, but for so many companies, they're obvious about it. It's a tax write-off. This is why we do this.
Yeah, I've watched that a little bit, and I don't have, I know there's plenty of data out there, but the tax write-offs in the Christian community are definitely a bonus. But just recently with the Tax Cuts and Jobs and Reconciliation Act, TSJA, maybe I'm not saying that, I don't think there's an R in there, Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. Yeah, that it'll expire at the end of 2025. They actually, the administration at the time, that was Trump administration, they really made the charitable gift irrelevant because everyone's standard deduction went up, and so charitable gifts are itemized deductions. And so most people who do charitable giving today don't even really get a tax deduction because it doesn't exceed their standard deduction. But people are still giving regardless because it's important to them. And so the tax deduction might move the needle a lot, but research doesn't show it moves it too much. So people give because of convictions.
Well, that is true. And listen, I live in the deep South. I mean, come June, we're going to start the first, 6 months of hurricane season every year. We do an awful lot of giving and donating and helping our neighbors out just because that's what we do. Mm-hmm. And we're not looking for tax write-offs. We're not looking for anything. I'll go into the Nextdoor app and somebody will say, my house just burned down or my neighbor's house just burned down. And all of a sudden, people from all over my little area here are saying, where can we donate? What do they need? Mm. It happens every day.
Yeah. I love the heart. I love the heart. It's just trying to do it on a regular basis, a consistent basis is a real challenge for all of us. The average American gives like 1.5%. We've made a lot of progress in our world, and giving has been a part of that progress, actually a significant part of the progress. But in the 80s, we had about a 40% global poverty rate. Now it's less than 10%. So we've done an incredible job. And I'd suggest to you, not only has capitalism played a role, but also, giving and missionaries that I specifically know. I started that one you mentioned in Moldova. Just a consistent cadence of giving because there's a consistent cadence of needs. And I'm seeing that more and more, and people are starting to think deeply about that. And because I've never seen a U-Haul behind a hearse. And the idea of, what are you going to do when it's all said and done? Are you just going to leave it to your kids? But giving while you're living is actually fun, and it's enjoyable, and it's mutually beneficial. And frankly, Notre Dame did some incredible studies here and said that you or us have less anxiety when we give. And so I think giving is a little understated. It's kind of paradoxical in a lot of ways, but then again, everything Jesus said was backwards, turn the other cheek. It's better to give than receive. Everything was backwards with him. So it doesn't surprise me that we do feel less anxiety when we give up money, when we think that we would reduce our anxiety by making more money, when in fact Jesus said, give it away and you'll actually have less anxiety. And Notre Dame study confirms that. It's kind of odd and peculiar, but it works.
Listen, I have heard stories. I have done this myself where, I might have five whole dollars in my wallet. I don't carry cash, but somebody may need that five whole dollars a lot more than I do, and they'll get it. Mm-hmm. If I think they really need it, I'm going to probably get myself a little bit of trouble here, but if somebody says, I need this, and they're whining at me, I tend not to be too charitable.
Yeah.
If you're whining at me and that's the best you've got, but if I can sense that you have genuine need, you're hungry, and I don't even care if you need to go have a drink. Once that money passes out of my hands, it is no longer my money. And a lot of people will say, and this bothers me a bit, well, I just don't want to give because he's just going to go get drunk. Not your business. Yeah, he probably is. But you gave that money. It's now his money. Back off.
Yep. No, that's good. That's real good. And it's always one of those tricky things, especially with our homeless population. One of the things that I was struggling with that because my kids are like, hey, let's give to this homeless guy. And their hearts are in the right place. Mm-hmm. And I don't mind periodically doing it. It's not a systematic thing, but I did tell them, I want you to know that what we're trying to do is we're trying to get to the source of these issues. And so what we found is this ministry that's very effective in and really providing all the resources in the foster care community, because what we're finding is a lot of the people that are homeless were, in the foster community that got kicked out because they're 18. And so I'm a strategic mind. So I want to, try to solve the problem, not the symptom. So although it's nice to give to them, and that's fine, it doesn't really solve the problem. So, you know, I found that a ministry called The Chosen Care. And so, you know, being engaged with them and being able to give to them is much more effective. And so I'd have to have that conversation with my kids. And then they're like, oh, that makes more sense. We'll try to get to the problem. And they know that they can walk alongside of that homeless person if they need to. And so there's several ministries out there that do that. So it's just about being very strategic and thoughtful. You know, in my scriptures, it says he didn't give us a spirit of timidity and boldness, but sound mind. And so sometimes Christians think about, you know, using their heart. But I read the scripture and it says, man, he gave us a sound mind, and we've got to use that sound mind whenever we do our giving or anything with money. And so going to the problem seems to be much more effective. Sometimes it's not as fun, but it is much more effective.
It is. And, you know, you'll hear stories. I've seen them. You know, there was one man and his wife that would sit at the corner of a shopping mall, not a shopping mall, but, you know, a parking lot. And then I would see them down the road in a car driving through a McDonald's. Like, I'm not giving you a dime. You're a grifter. You're not homeless. You're a grifter. These people exist, but use your own, I don't know, instincts. You know, our instincts as humans are typically, I like to believe anyway, pretty good. You can tell the whiners from the fakers, from the people who, oh my God, I'm hungry. You can tell if you really pay attention.
Yeah, it doesn't take long. A little observation and you can see if they're scamming you for sure. They're out there. I know I've been burned on them before, but you know, there's just whole systems, and there's homeless systems of taking advantage of people. And that does exist. And some people may scream at me and say, well, you're not sympathetic. I'm just speaking the exact truth. In fact, if you look at my wallet, you'll see I'm very sympathetic, but for us to say that there's not a system of manipulation out there, there is. And so you just have to be thoughtful about how you navigate through that.
Exactly. So let's go back to, you know, some of the book, because I have questions. I tell you, I got sticky notes everywhere. What is behavioral finance? Can you shed some light on that?
Sure. Yeah, that's the collision of psychology, neuroscience, and traditional finance, like therapy sprinkled all through it. But it's just this idea that people, you know, the idea of money is not just math. And we've recognized Daniel Kahneman, who just recently passed away, spoke deeply about this and really was kind of the founder of behavioral finance, where we try to understand how to help people accomplish their goals, but think about human behavior along the way. Like a key element to this is, say you're just like a spender and you just spend money and you have a hard time saving. And so you have to have life hacks. So it's a matter of, okay, you need to save 15% of your gross income towards retirement. I know that. I know Social Security is not going to be there. So setting up an automatic draft out of your bank account because you can't do it on your own is a way of adopting a behavioral finance tool, just kind of a non-behavioral finance tool. That would be a behavior modification, is if you have a hard time working out, but you set your gym clothes right at your bed, right when you wake up. You know, those are just like life hacks that when you study behavioral finance, which is neuroscience, psychology, and traditional finance, you look for these ways to not just hack life, but to find avenues that can increase probabilities of success. One thing that happens a lot in my world, because we manage a lot of people's money, is, and this is the neuroscience part, you see people's the little almond shape, I guess pecan shape, whatever that is, in the front of your head called the amygdala. That amygdala gets hijacked whenever the market goes down. And so people are susceptible of calling me and pulling their money out right when the market goes down. And so what skills do I need to have, whether it's therapist or psychology skills, to help them weather that? Because the evidence shows that pulling out in those times is foolishness. And so that's just kind of the application of how you take this idea of neuroscience, the amygdala, psychology, how to communicate these things, and then going to the traditional finance of the math, what works, and applying it in such a way that people look back over 20 years and say, okay, I had a lot of success. If you discount the behavioral part, it's really hard just to lean in the math, because we're just human and we get distracted and we're flawed.
Exactly. And one of my favorite chapters is chapter 6, Allergic to Debt. And you talk about Dave Ramsey a good bit in this chapter. You have worked with him before, I believe.
Yeah, I was on his advisory council for a number of years. And so I think highly of what he's done for a lot of people.
So why are we allergic to debt? Which
Yeah.
sounds like when I said it, I went, well, duh.
Yeah. You
It
know, it's,
sounded stupid even to me.
yeah, exactly. You know, the really what I was trying to get at there was helping the reader understand that there's actually, you know, when you think about Christians specifically, there's actually some theology behind debt that drive their behavior. And I think this, when I was trying to make this case to executives, let's say at Goldman Sachs, they if they don't understand that Christians are generally allergic to debt, you know, there's a scripture that says the borrower is the slave to the lender. That's they can miss an opportunity because they may sell to the Christian community the idea of using leverage to be able to enhance returns if they don't recognize that Christians in general and those people who share Christian values. One of their values is to not have debt, they will be missing the boat. And I've seen that before. It's like a total miss. They'll go in and manufacture products using leverage and debt to enhance returns and then pitch it to a group of people that have been following Ramsey or are allergic to debt or have or use their Bible to guide them when it comes to debt. They'll pitch these products to them and totally realize that they've almost offended this group of people, that they've said that debt is something that I'm going to use to enhance return. And it just, it's something that there's this cognitive dissonance that says, I understand that the math says that the Goldman Sachs, but the reality is my convictions say debt is bad. And so the case I'm making is to the secularists is just try to say that the Christians and those that share the values are allergic to debt.
And one of the things that I found really fascinating in here on page 39, many times debt is the only way to pay medical bills. Let's dive into that.
Yeah, that's tough. You know, I've had a sick family members. My son was sick quite a bit and he's healthy today, praise God. But he you know, it's hard. You know, medical bills are really a major cause of bankruptcy for and a lot of financial stress for people. And so sometimes the reality is that you feel and again working with thousands of people they feel less than, they feel that they failed in life if they've accumulated medical debt. And so what I'd like to get across to that group of people is that it's not an identity thing, it's just circumstantial. And you definitely can get through this. The most doctor's office and most hospitals I know, because I've had to walk down this road before, are accommodative. And so working with them on payment plans that's within reason, paying those off. There's pride in paying them off. Some people, I don't know a lot of people that will just simply say, I'm not going to pay off my debts. You're out there and that's okay. But I know that
Student
generally
loans right now is the big bugaboo.
student loans are huge. But if you look at the Christian community, what I've noticed on, they want to pay down these debts. They really do. It's like an honorable thing. And so one of the things I've had to talk with them about the Christian community, because they have so much conviction about honoring what these payments that it, you know, let's come up with something that's reasonable. And so, this, you're right, student loans and medical debt, those are the big issues today.
And you talk in here, and I didn't underline this, but I came close. I won't. My pen is always far, far away from any book that's on my desk. You said, but if Christians rack up a pile of medical debts on their credit cards, they plan to repay it. They will customize the terms, negotiate the rates, ask for discounts, and find a way to pay off the debt.
It's just an honor thing. It's just a deeply held conviction. It's honorable to pay off a debt. You owe it. I don't know a lot of Christians who just not don't pay it. I know it's out there, but many of them will.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that does make sense. I had to have eye surgery a few years back, and it was going to be problematic. It really was. And then somebody said, well, go to this ophthalmologist. He will do cash. You pay cash to his office and you get a huge discount. One of the best ophthalmologists around. Thank goodness.
Yeah, that's nice. Cash is amazing, especially when you're on the sharing plans. You're using cash a lot more. It's considerable difference in cost. for sure.
Yeah, it really is. So we're going to run out of time pretty soon. Every time I talk with you, it's like, oh, that hour went too quickly.
It did, yeah.
What exactly is a donor advised funds? Because I know you work with a lot of your clients, and you've talked about asking them, do you want to be in this? Where do you want to be? But what is a donor advised fund? That one stumped me. I have no idea what that is.
Yeah, donor advised fund allows somebody to make a charitable, a legal charitable contribution into an account and then give it away later. So let's say you're at the end of the year and you need a big tax deduction. You could put the money in an account and then you're like, I just don't know who to give it to yet. I don't feel comfortable. So you put in the account, you get the tax deduction and it sits there. And then later, anytime you're not forced, you can give it away later. And so that's the very basics of it. But the couple of advantages of it, first of all, it gives you that tax deduction immediately. Two, a lot of people like to give anonymously. So you can name this fund something else and then give it to a charity anonymously. And so a lot of people like to use these donor advised funds as a way to give to nonprofits around the world.
Well, and that makes sense, because listen, when, and I'll tell anybody who cares, everything I've got is going to, pets. If you've got a great rescue, you're going to get some money from me. That's just all there is to it. So,
Love it.
like, really, my best friend and I, her sister died very unexpectedly, and we all of a sudden realized it's probably time to update or revisit, who's going to be doing who for what, who's, taking care of my estate, blah blah blah. You get the idea. And she said, I just don't want some people in my family to just walk in and take everything, and they will. And I said, well, what if we're both big pet people? I have cats. Everybody knows I have cats and a dog. And I said, well, what about some, really well-known, high integrity, highly ethical pet shelters? And off we went. And it made us both feel like, okay, I don't mind working for this. I don't mind working towards that. They deserve it.
Yeah, that's good. And I'm a rescue dog guy and we have cats. So I think once you have that conviction and then you're aligning your money with that conviction and you're investing time, I think life then starts to make a little bit more sense. And it's
Does. And I'm glad you said that, because like once we both landed on that, I went, oh. So all of a sudden now I'm on Facebook and I have several different charities that I will always support. And there's human charities, the Tunnel to Towers, there's Wounded Warriors. I will always support them. But once you find these people, these groups, these entities that do connect with you at almost every level, support them.
Yeah, there's a lot of needs out there, a ton of them, and so it's just being aware. Hopefully anybody listening now will kind of put their radar on for a nonprofit or a community that really needs their time and attention. It's a game changer in life. It really is.
And I have one last question, I think. Chapter 7, the transfer of multi-generational wealth. And you said that baby boomers will transfer more than 30 trillion with a T of wealth to the next generation through gifts and inheritances over the next 2 decades. I'll be honest with you, I have never been one of those people who thinks that because you have a son or a daughter that they need to have all your money. I think they need to earn their own, but what do I know?
Well, it makes sense. It's really a tricky one. Warren Buffett said that he's not leaving his kids anything. He
I read
is
that.
he, yeah, his quote is I don't want to rob them of the character building opportunity to build their own wealth, which is so good. And then I have other good, well-meaning people that are comfortable leaving it to the next generation. And so obviously very personal. There's some scriptures that says a wise man leaves an inheritance to his children's children. It's my conviction that you leave inheritance is what you leave to somebody, but a legacy is what you leave in someone. And so, there's obviously, different points of view there, but generally speaking, I think we just have to be very thoughtful about leaving money to the ne next generation and how it could rob them of really what it means to build character in life and what hard work means. So, some people just kind of say, well, you know, when I die, I die. It's, I think that's, you know, being disingenuous and obviously harmful. So being thoughtful about your wills and your trust is important.
And having those conversations before all of the
Yeah,
expenses
right.
in front of the attorneys, because oh my goodness.
Yeah, exactly. It's a great point.
Well, Daryl, I really appreciate your company today. So, do you have any last thoughts or, things that people really need to kind of cogitate on before I let you go?
No, I covered a lot of ground, so I appreciate you just asking all the tough questions and kind of digesting this. And I appreciate your review and your support. So it means a lot.
My pleasure. I always love having you on the show. So, spending, like I said, spending time with you is a pleasure. And where can people find you? And where can they find this book? And if they want to talk with you at the PAX group, give them that information as well.
Yeah, so the book's at every major retailer for books. You know, Amazon's easy. Barnes Noble's is another option. And then LinkedIn's a real good way to connect with me. So you can just go to LinkedIn and find me because I put a lot of content out there on LinkedIn. And then PAX Financial Group's our website. There's actually a contact us button. It's really easy to find on the first page. That's also a good place. So those are a couple options that I would lean into, and those three. Yeah.
Now, this isn't your only book. Can you
No,
tell us
this is
very
the f
quickly about the other books that you
yeah
have?
the first one's Small Business Big Pressure. That helps people navigate small business. The next one's The Grand Money Chasm, really designed for grandparents, really small book as well. The third one's 18 to 80, everything you need to be doing with your money from age 18 to age 80. And then this last one, Biblical Responsible Investing.
What's next for you?
Oh, I don't know, you know, whatever the Lord decides. But I do have a couple other books in me, so I'm a thinker, and so kind of thinking through those.
Good for you. Well, when you're ready to come back, you know what to do. You just call me or send me an email and we'll get you back on the show.
Yeah, thank you so much. That means a lot.
Oh, my pleasure. Well, listen to the audience. As we conclude today's episode, your feedback means a lot. So if you found the show helpful, please support us with a quick review on iTunes. And this is why I ask, because your input is vital in my mission to inspire and empower more individuals. So don't forget to hit subscribe, leave a review, and share your Partner in Success Radio with friends and colleagues. And be sure to go find Daryl Lyons on the web, grab that book, and connect with him. And thank you for tuning in. And I will see you next week. Daryl, again, thank you so much.
Thank you. Have a good weekend.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Get your voice heard. If you would like to launch your own far-reaching podcast, contact Denise Griffiths at yourofficeontheweb.com and go to the podcast tab.